Ink and Paint wishes to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded and edited. It is a great privilege to be able to tell stories on this land, which has a tradition of storytelling stretching back over 10,000 years. We also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from all over the world where our guests record from. We pay our respects to all elders past, present, and emerging, and to our First Nations listeners. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Ink and Paint, a podcast journey through the Disney animated classics. I'm your host, Daniel Lamon. We'll be exploring one by one the films in the official Disney animated canon and talking about their artistic, historical, and social context, where they came from, their impact, and how they sit with us now. First of all, thank you for all the wonderful responses and support for our first episode. It's always very nerve-wracking launching any new project, and I'll be honest, I didn't get a lot of sleep the night before the first episode dropped, so it's been really terrific to hear what people have enjoyed so far. It's going to be a long and hopefully thrilling journey through these films, so hopefully you'll stick around for the ride. Each episode on Ink and Paint, I'm joined by a special guest, not just film and animation enthusiasts, but people from all different professions. This week, we have the second half of my chat with Melbourne-based producer and director Nicholas Koller, and our look at five of the animated shorts released by Walt Disney Productions before the release of Snow White in 1937. If you haven't heard the first half, make sure you go back and have a listen as we talk about the early days of the company, the debut of Mickey Mouse and Steamboat Willie, and the first of the Silly Symphonies, The Skeleton Dance. For this week's episode, we're continuing with the Silly Symphonies with Flowers and Trees in 1932, Three Little Pigs in 1933, and The Old Mill in 1937. The success of The Skeleton Dance allowed Walt and Roy Disney to secure distribution rights for the Silly Symphony series through Columbia Pictures, and over the next 3 years they released 26 new Silly Symphony shorts, during which time both Ub Iwerks and Carl Starling left the studio. While they were certainly popular, they couldn't match the popularity of Mickey Mouse or the Fleischer brothers Betty Boop. Distribution shifted to United Artists in 1932, who insisted that Mickey Mouse's name be associated with the series, even though he didn't appear in them. The shorts were now credited as Mickey Mouse Presents A Silly Symphony. Until this point, all the shorts produced by Walt Disney Productions were in black and white. In fact, no animated short had ever been released in full colour, and only a few films had experimented with early processes that would lead to Technicolor. This series, though, was proving a perfect testing ground for new technologies, and just as he had done with sound in Steamboat Willie, Walt Disney decided to push the frontier of animation one step further with the 1932 Silly Symphony, Flowers and Trees. Two trees fight for the affection of a female tree, but when the ugly, gnarly tree loses, he sets this forest on fire. The flowers and plants try to put it out, but the birds eventually poke holes in the clouds and make it rain. The two trees fall in love and get married. Flowers and Trees was the 29th Silly Symphony, but also the first commercially released film produced in full colour, three-strip Technicolor. It was originally developed as a black and white short, but when Disney was approached by Herbert Kalmus, the inventor of Technicolor, to test out the three-strip process with animation, he decided to have the film reshot. The short was directed by Burt Gillett, who directed 15 of the Silly Symphonies and won 2 Oscars. It went wildly over budget after the transition to colour and threatened to ruin the studio, but was an enormous success, and afterwards, all Silly Symphonies were produced in colour. So, first obvious question, Nick, had you seen Flowers and Trees before?
Yes, I had. I had definitely seen it. What was really interesting about this is I feel like it's very clear the advancement in applying narrative to their shorts. You've got the introduction, a very clear introduction of a villain and an actual narrative arc. It just really shows the progression in this storytelling, particularly as it still was part of the whole Silly Symphony thing.
And it doesn't have, this is similar to Skeleton Dance, there's no dialogue in this particular film, but like the character animation in this is really great. Like it's very, you don't need any exposition to explain or give context to who these characters are, because I mean, you know who the villain is as soon as you see him, this horrible gnarly tree with all of these vultures sitting on top of him. And my favorite detail is the fact that his tongue is a lizard, like an angry lizard that spits. So when he opens his mouth, this lizard pops out. Or that, you know, you've got the female tree, which is a kind of Mae West figure, almost taut, like lanky and curved, with these like the beautiful pom-poms of, you know, green leaves. And all the character animation for all of the animals and the plants is really fun and really clear. That you can almost see like a hierarchy within this particular forest. Yeah, there's kind of no waste in this particular film. It just gets on with the story and enjoys itself.
I also think that, like, the introduction of colour aside, the level in detail in the animation, I think, and I don't know whether that is because of the introduction of the Technicolor, but it's really advanced, I think, as opposed to the previous two shorts. But particularly with, like, it's really interesting that with, again, Technicolor is new. This is the first time it's been used. It's a new technology. And the depth and detail in how they've used it to help advance the story. So, for example, you know, you've got a really good use of color to indicate good versus evil immediately, regardless of, like, how the characters actually look. The two good trees are in this really rich scape of bright, light spring colors, but then immediately, as soon as you see the evil tree, he's dull and drab and is very grey and everything around him is very grey. It's really interesting that, you know, not only have they used colour really for the first time, but they've used it so well in helping actually be not just colour as a new thing, but colour as a way of using it to help tell the story. It's really interesting.
We could probably say the same for something like Steamboat Willie, where the technological advance is not seen as a novelty. It's kind of like James Cameron using 3D for Avatar. It's not a novelty. It's integral to the telling of the story. Here, like the fact that I don't think the color red appears in flowers and trees until the fire is started. So you all of a sudden you have this very strong color contrast happening to show that there's been a tonal shift or a narrative shift. Yet it's thought through, which is pretty significant considering it's a film that was started in one particular style and having to be rethought as another. And so they would have had to work through it pretty quickly, I imagine.
Yeah, and I can see how that would have totally tipped it over budget, because having just had my first foray into animation, and when you have no idea what you're doing, it is very easy to spend your dollars very quickly.
What was that like? What was the process for you learning how to tell a story in animation when animation is not your primary storytelling form?
I mean, pretty terrifying, particularly as, so just to give a bit of a background of the short, it is set in live action. So we doubled down stupidly because it is set in live action, a live action world, but our lead character is a stop motion animated skeleton. And then we have another character called Tootie Booty. That's a traditional sort of 2D cell animation. We have a CGI motion capture monster. Basically, the short explores the history of animation and visual effects.
Small story, not ambitious at all.
And yeah, no, exactly right. Yeah, when you don't have any money, what should you do? Try and do all the animations in one when you've never done one before. It was pretty terrifying because it's just so different. The process is so different. And you're really relying on the experience of the people that you get on board to help guide you, particularly with the stop motion, because, yeah, it's just such a different world, and it's one that requires patience and understanding and really leaning on your animators, because, you know, I can't even draw. I'm not from, and neither can the director, and neither can, oh, the director can a little bit, but we're definitely none of us animators. And so it was really interesting having an idea on what we thought it would be and then leaning on the brilliance of our animators, particularly our stop motion animator, to really bring the character to life. When, I mean, we had a joke through it that our lead character, Phil, who's a stop motion animated skeleton, has literally only got like 12 emotions. Like, he only has 12 interchangeable faces. So trying to use body movement and the way that he moves and reacts to things with little tiny movements that help sell his feelings and emotion, because it's also a silent film. There's no dialogue in the film. Just completely opened my eyes to what is possible in animation. Again, that you can't do in live action, really. But yeah, it was terrifying. I'm still kind of aghast that we pulled it off, I think. But yeah, it was certainly, playing with all this new technology that we've never played with before was terrifying. And in a way, stupid, but it came off. So hey ho.
So when you are working with the animation technology, were you thinking about it in terms of its use primarily to serve the narrative and the characters, or was there a certain degree which you were trying things out to go like, what can we do with this?
Well, I guess because the short inherently was about the history of visual effects. And so basically the quick log line of the film is it's about a stop motion skeleton circa Jason and the Argonauts that can't get a job in the modern day because he's been usurped by better animation.
It's so charming.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a comment on the spate of reboots, because in the film he discovers that the film that made him famous is being rebooted without him, and he's been replaced by somebody in a motion capture suit. So it was really sort of a comment on the spate of remakes and, you know, the need for live action and stuff as opposed to traditional methods, but also kind of like a bit of a love letter to the history of animation and visual effects. So a lot of that kind of influenced what we were using and why, and particularly with stop motion, because we didn't have a whole lot of money, we played around with the idea of making it partially stop motion, but, you know, mainly visual effects. But we really wanted to keep, you know, you can't sort of make a love letter to something and then completely throw out the way it was animated. Interestingly enough, the short started out as having a lot of dialogue, and we actually came over 4 or 5 drafts. It ended up coming to the conclusion that actually it was better as a silent film, better without dialogue, which was a really interesting thing to come to, because we felt like the animation kind of did the work. There was no need for dialogue in it.
And how did that, a reductive way to ask this question, but how did that feel to make that decision? Because, I mean, that's, you know, we're talking about with Flowers and Trees, another short that doesn't use dialogue to tell its story. What was it like transitioning from that moment of going, we are using dialogue to help with the exposition and the narrative, to not using that?
Really interesting, because the character also started out as, before the decision to go, you know, dialogueless, the character was kind of a dick, because the whole film is sort of about how grumpy he is with the state of the industry. And also too, it's, you know, it had a lot to do with the fact that his creator had passed away, who was like a stalwart of the animation industry. And so he was like a heavily smoking, drinking kind of dick. And just really mean. And it was so interesting that when you took the dialogue away, that, I mean, he still drinks a lot in the film. It doesn't smoke anymore, but he still drinks a lot. But it's kind of endearing. It really changed the character. It kind of made him a character that was so much more easy to empathize with, rather than a character in the beginning who kind of, like, yeah, was a bit unlikable and really hard to kind of get on board with.
Going back to what you were saying earlier about the character animation is something like Flowers and Trees. I mean, not having dialogue means you have to really work on what the animation, like the concept and execution of the character is, in order to be able to tell the story. Like, you need to, you know, instantaneously know who this person is the moment they appear on screen. I guess it means it really does promote an economy of storytelling and a clarity of storytelling, which is, I think, it's always that rule of, like, you know, show, don't tell, particularly with something like a visual medium like cinema, that it's much better to be able to show an audience as opposed to tell them that.
Oh, absolutely. And exposition is dumb. Like, exposition is such a lazy way of telling a story. So it's so much more interesting when you're given the tools the restrictions to not be able to do that, not be able to explain something. Like, how do you do it? How do you get it across without being on the nose or obvious about it? Like, it's so much, it makes things so much more interesting, because you're forced to do things that you are like, okay, well, maybe this will get that across. And it becomes more holistic in terms of, like, how to get ideas across, rather than, you know, often when we get notes back from networks and stuff, you'll get notes a lot of the time that are like, well, can we put a line in here explaining this a bit, because we don't think audiences will get it, which is insane, because audiences, like, quite often people that are giving you the money forget that audiences are smart, and they're getting smarter. And subsequently, you don't have to explain things. It's so much better if you let people do the work, because they want to feel, you know, that's how you get them engaged. You make them do the work. Like, I like walking out of films and you know, watching at the end of TV series when I know that I've had to, like, things have shocked me and there's been twists and I've had to actually work things out. You know, even for films that I don't like. Like, a good example of that is, you know, Mother from years ago. And I know this is going slightly off topic, but...
Wow. Welcome to our Disney podcast. We're going to talk about Darren Aronofsky's Mother.
No, just like, in terms of, like, having to walk away from something that I didn't necessarily like, but it made me work. Like, I really had to work during that film. And I like that. I like that, you know, when you've actually got to work things out for yourself rather than being told what's going on, which is what's really cool about these early shorts, is that they're such efficient narratives, and they use everything that they have available to them to tell things visually rather than sit there for, you know, 8 to 10 minutes telling you what's going on. It's great.
And you feel like in those 7 to 8 minutes, because they're all around the same length, you feel like you've gotten something full and satisfying within them. Like Flowers and Trees is very simple. It's very storybook in its kind of the kind of story it's telling. But you don't walk away from it regretting any moment of watching it, or you don't walk away with it wishing that there was a moment more or a moment less. And I actually would argue that that is a pretty consistent quality of Disney animated feature films right up until Disney's death. So right up until, I think, the marker is The Jungle Book. They are all great examples of economy of storytelling, economy of character development, and show, don't tell. Like, you know, the prime example we'll talk about at some point in an episode further is the death of Bambi's mother. Like, you don't see Bambi's mother's death. You hear the gunshot, you hear the silence, and the only indication that you've had that she's died, you don't see her body. You just, you know, the king of the forest says to Bambi, your mother can't be with you anymore. And then it cuts to a shot of Bambi looking up and a single tear goes from his eye. It's like, you don't need anything else other than that. It says everything else it needs to say. I mean, we're talking about something far more frivolous with something like Flowers and Trees, and definitely to segue into the next short where story and character become really important. It's a lot. This is all in service of just pure enjoyable entertainment. But those building blocks are really there in those foundation stones of just, it's all about the story. It's all about the characters. Technology is great, but it's there to serve.
Absolutely. And also too, just in terms of that, you know, talking about the advancement in their abilities to tell a narrative, it may seem like, I mean, I think over the course of the shorts that we're talking through, it's like, what, five, six, 7 years or something like that, which considering from the start of Steamboat Willie to eventually when we get to the Old Mill, it's like the narrative, the ability to kind of infuse a narrative into their work comes so far in that 5, 6, 7 years. Whereas, and that sounds like a long time, but it's really not. Like, that's very quick progression, considering at the same time they're technologically advancing with the use of sound and Technicolor and animation styles. That's really, really quick.
That's the great thing about this kind of first age in the history of Disney animation, is that none of the advancements in the form are minor. Like, even if you look, again, we'll get onto it in the second and third episodes, but you look at the difference between Snow White and Pinocchio. These are two films that are a few years apart, and the difference in terms of what they achieve is astronomical. Like, it's kind of staggering to look at how far the form is moving. It was one of the reasons why I chose these particular five shorts, is because they represent the leaping points where you see how huge those leaps are. You know, this is quite a few years after the skeleton dance, but it's kind of like it's kind of nuts how far they're going. And then when you jump into the next one, it even more so in terms of how sophisticated they are.
Oh, but also too, this is at a time when, you know, technology by all rights should have advanced slowly. It wasn't like, you know, there was a 22-year-old in a basement writing code for a program to advance CGI. Like, this is stuff that would have taken, you know, nobody was Googling or YouTubing, you know, how to code, blah, blah, blah. You can see how eloquent I am with technology stuff. But this was at a time when, you know, technology advancement rightfully took time because there was no easy fix. It was much more complicated than it is now. So, yeah, by that note, it's almost more staggering.
And I mean, you know, I've kind of made a mistake really by assuming the knowledge of our listeners in terms of their knowledge of the animation process. But like, you know, film is 24 frames per second. Each one of those frames in an animated film is animated by a human being. Now, you know, in the height of the Disney Renaissance in the 90s, you had hundreds of different animators working on films in order to execute that. We're talking about something like Steamboat Willie and The Skeleton Dance. They're entirely animated by one person with a pen and paper and ink, bringing these things to life. And this is in the days where, like, animation was not, they still didn't quite understand what animation was as a form. Like, if you look at the wider story of animation at this particular period, you have a lot of experimental animated films of people trying to see, you know, this is the 1920s and 30s, so you're coming off the back of expressionism and impressionism and all of these art movements, and animation is reflecting that. We think of animation very much in the terms of the Disney style, which is then adopted by anime and adopted by other animation companies around the world, but there are experiments happening at this same time with what animation can be. And it's important to remember, like, you look at something like Flowers and Trees, you know, he develops it as a black and white short and then goes, no, we've got to do it in color. And all of a sudden, these people who've never made a color animated color film before, who probably only like 5 or 6 people really, are all of a sudden having to go, how the fuck do we do that? Like, what does that mean? Like, and this is the same way of like Iwerks and Disney being like, how the fuck do we do sound? And actually, a story I didn't tell about Steamboat Willie, which is pretty fucking incredible, was that they had to prove it would work, because a lot of people, there was a thought that sound and animation would just be too much, the same way people thought a feature-length animated film would be too much and would be ridiculous. So what they did was they animated it, and then they Iwerks set up a sheet in a hall in somewhere in the studio, and he sat behind the behind the sheet, which was having the film projected on it, and he did a live Foley performance of the sound in Steamboat Willie before they recorded it to prove that sound and animation would go well together.
That is nuts.
And that's the thing. Like, we're talking about people on the forefront of an art form with this. Like, you know, when you get to the second wind in Disney post the war, this is where they've kind of worked out the production line of it. But everything up until Bambi is them trying things that no one has ever tried before. You know, Disney's coming to the people and going, I want you to try this. But, you know, yes, Disney's the person that conceives of it and finances it along with Roy and, you know, pushes them towards perfection. But then there are these people that are getting their hands dirty. Like, can you imagine for a director like Burt Gillett to like have all of a sudden be like, I have to direct color. Color is a new thing, not just in terms of animation, but just in general. What does color mean in storytelling? It's insane. It's insane that when we look at them all like as a wide narrative, these 5 shorts, that we can go from a short like Steamboat Willie in 1927, I think, and 10 years later, we're looking at The Old Mill, which we'll get to.
Yeah, it's an insanely quick progression.
But these advances, luckily, were rewarded because Flowers and Trees is also significant, and it is the very first recipient of the Best Short Subject Cartoon Oscar at the 5th Academy Awards in 1932. Because of that, it was the first animated film of any kind to win an Oscar. Now, all of a sudden, animated films can be rewarded in some capacity. Before then, there was still a lot of subjects about them being for kids. You know, that, you know, they're not a high art form, but this is an acknowledgement of its artistic importance. Which moves us into our next short. We're jumping forward to 1933 to what is regarded as the most successful animated short ever made, Three Little Pigs. This is the story of the three little pigs who built the houses out of straw, sticks, and bricks, and how they escaped the big bad wolf. Three Little Pigs was the 36th Silly Symphony short, and also directed by Burt Gillett, for which he earned his second Oscar. It was released at the height of the Great Depression, and was a huge financial and cultural success. Its title song, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf, composed by Frank Churchill, who would go on to compose music for many of the first feature-length animated films, was a hit single and became an unexpected anthem during the Depression. It also garnered admiration and attention for its well-developed plot and characters, and led to the formation of the story department, which would become integral to the animation process. This is kind of one of those shorts that I think everybody has seen in some capacity, or at least definitely heard of.
Yeah, I would had 100% seen this before.
But how fucking great is it? Like, it's such a great piece of storytelling.
It's really great. It's really great. The thing that I'm most interested about with the Three Little Pigs is what you just touched on, and actually the relevance it had to what was going on in the world, and the effect that it had because of that, because arguably that could have been released at a different point in time and not been anywhere near as successful. And, you know, I know we don't want to touch on it too much, but particularly the time that we're going through right now, I find it really interesting to think of.
No, we should definitely talk about it in the context of what's happening now, yes.
Well, because if you, let's say you look at Three Little Pigs, right? The time of the Great Depression, it's really interesting that the film revolves around three characters, two of which decide to kind of like do it on their own. And then the third one, essentially, they end up working together in a sense, or he ends up, you know, helping them in a way to defeat a common enemy. Whereas at the time, you know, everybody, you know, much like now, and the hoarding of people, you know, pushing each other out of the way to get a roll of toilet paper or whatever, it's because people were desperate. And in those times, people were desperate. So to release a film which was essentially about taking care of each other against a common enemy, which was, you know, the Great Depression, is brilliant. Like, no wonder it did so well, because it gives hope, and it's done in such a way that's so light and colourful and joyous that not only was it a lovely antidote, I'm sure, to the misery, but it also gave people something to bandy together. And you know, one of the things I love about film is that it allows people, you know, through story, to feel like they've been heard and to feel like they have something like a barometer of how to deal with what's going on around them. And this is a perfect example of that.
I think a lot of the reason for this film's success is the song, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf? Because it has such a, like, you look at it in the context of the film and, you know, it starts off as being, you know, a foolish rhyme to say, because of course you have every reason to be afraid of the Big Bad Wolf because your house is made of straw or sticks. But at the end, when they overcome the adversity of like, they defeat the wolf, it becomes a thing of like, no, we can do this. Like, we are capable of defending ourselves and taking care of ourselves and overcoming an insurmountable obstacle. And there is something thinking about it in the context of the Great Depression, it would have been quite a moving thing to think about, a moving proposition to put to your audience of going, actually, we can get through this. I mean, the same as way is that at the moment now, at the time of recording, like we said at the beginning, we're in the, you know, at the very early days of the coronavirus pandemic, and anything that is put forward to us as, you know, culturally that suggests kindness and working together and thinking of others seems really radical and powerful at the moment. And, you know, this is a period where people have, in the Great Depression, lost their jobs, don't know how they're going to feed themselves. And, you know, yet they're using the little money they have to go and see a short about three pigs running away from a wolf, because it has, yeah, there's kind of a beautiful emotional impact to that. And I think a lot of that also has to do with the fact the storytelling is so clear, and that the story is quite complex, certainly by comparison to something like Flowers and Trees. There's a lot going on in this and a lot of character detail. There's a DVD that is very hard to find. It's like it's like buying on eBay. It's like $500 now. There was a DVD release of the Silly Symphony shorts in the 2000s at some point, which I picked up, thank God, as, you know, in my late teens, early 20s. And in an introduction to this short, Leonard Moulton talks about the fact that one of the significant things about this short is that you have three characters, all of the same species, three pigs, but they're all distinct characters in their own, and how that was itself a radical notion in animation. Because, I mean, you have something like Flowers and Trees. There are three trees, but their discernible characteristics are just kind of like a base, like they're not complex. With these three characters, the three pigs, each of them have a very strong personality. They sound very different. And even the way that the wolf interacts with each of them is very distinct. He doesn't approach each of them in the same way. And the wolf as a villain is probably the best character, because there's so much fun being had with him. He's not just walking up and, you know, blowing the house down. He's finding interesting ways. Like, I love how macabre the moment is where he covers himself in the sheepskin and hides in the basket and pretends to be a sheep, like pretends to be a lamb. Like, it's so macabre, particularly because it's like, I imagine you killed that sheep, but sure, cover yourself in its skin. But it is, again, it's really, really charming. And the story makes sense. It goes somewhere. It has a climax. It builds really beautifully to that climax. And another thing I also noted about it when I was watching it was, in a way, like, I wondered whether this is maybe an early blueprint for a musical.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I was going to say, I think this is the most clear picture of what Disney animation would become in its heights, in the height of its powers.
Totally, totally. With the history of musical theatre, it's, you know, the idea of music telling the story is still, I don't think at this point, if it hasn't an idea that popped up at all, it's very new. So the idea of the music being like, you know, because the music is kind of the texture in Flowers and Trees and the Skeleton Dance. Here it's integral to the narrative that this, like, this is the thing that's driving the story forward. There's spoken dialogue, but a lot of the story is told through this single song that's sung over the course of the 8 minutes. Yeah, it feels like this is just a few steps away from Little Mermaid or, you know, Beauty and the Beast or even Cinderella or Alice in Wonderland, like using music as an integral part of the story. So this one, like Flowers and Trees, this one is also on Disney Plus. But there is one fact about this film that I did want to talk about before we go into last few general comments on it, which is that this is the only one of these shorts that has gone through censorship. So Disney's quite well known for its tendency to go back and change its films in order to remove questionable content, the most famous one being the changes to Fantasia, which we'll definitely talk about when we get to Fantasia. But this is another example of one of those instances. So in the original version, so in the film, they get to the House of Bricks, the wolf comes to the door, knocks at the door, and pretends to be a salesman that's selling brushes, and the third pig steals a brush from his hand and closes the door to say, I know that you'll the wolf go away. In the version that you'll see on Disney Plus, it is he's a door-to-door salesman called the Fuller Brush Man. Fuller Brush was a company from that period, and the Fuller Brush Man was basically a door-to-door salesman going around selling brushes to people at the door. That's a reanimation of what it used to be. Originally, it was a Jewish peddler. So on the Walt Disney Treasures Silly Symphonies DVD version that I have, it retains the peddler animation, which isn't in the Disney Plus version. Yeah. Though, I mean, in the context, it was one of the arguments put forward to that he was anti-Semitic. The important thing to remember about that is, like, it's not a good stereotype, but it was a stereotype that was very common in film and culture at that time. So it's not, they would not have seen it as being racially insensitive by using it. It would have just been, oh, we're just using it. Now we look at it and go, that's problematic. And so now we have the version you'll see on Disney Plus is the reanimated version, and the redubbed version. But yeah, it's quite shocking actually, because so much of I watched that version again today before recording, and it's so, like, you can find it online. It's not subtle, and it feels entirely unnecessary, because it's actually one of the only times in any of the shorts we've watched where the real world steps into these shorts.
And in such a problematic way.
Yeah. This is a question that will come up a lot, I think, in talking about the history of Disney animation. But this decision to reanimate it, how do you feel about that? As a film lover, how do you feel about this process that Disney goes through?
Look, it is difficult. I understand, think about it particularly with things that are now very outdated. I mean, there are outdated things all throughout these shorts. Like, the fact that in Steamboat Willie, I know that it's where the rest of the short takes place, but the fact that Minnie, the first time you see Minnie dropped onto the boat, she's dropped in front of the kitchen, and then her dress is pulled down because it's, stuff like that, stuff of the two trees quabbling over the, you know, very, let's, for lack of a better term, I won't say sexy, she's not a sexy tree, she's a beautiful tree, right? All that kind of stuff. It's really hard because it's like the equivalent of your talking about a grandparent when they've said something and you go, well, but they're of a time. It's tricky because that is 100% true, but at the same time, do you overlook it? It's such a complicated, it's really complicated. Like, I think to go back and change it, I think is difficult. I don't mind, I'm yet to see it, but for example, not to dip too much into the live action Disney stuff, but the take on Mulan looks really interesting. Whether it'll be any good, who knows? But then in Guy Ritchie's Aladdin, there was that really weird song they included, which was like this song of empowerment for Jasmine, which you're like, oh, I understand why you've added that, but at the same time, that's so weird. So I don't know. It's such a hard thing to tiptoe around because so much looking back now, and not just Disney, you know, film as a whole, there's so many things that looking back, there's so many problematic things of films in different, you know, points of history. So I think films probably just need to be left, and we just need to be able to acknowledge that you know, certain things that happened in them were problematic because of the time. I don't think necessarily going back and, you know, recutting and changing things. I mean, look, it depends how hard it is. It depends how bad it is. But yeah, I don't know. It's, I guess you're kind of changing what it was. And in a way, you know, they were a moment in history. Whereas, I mean, you know, if all of these were changed to be up with the times, we wouldn't be able to track the social and political relevance of what was going on at the time. So arguably, they just need to be left alone, and we just need to be okay with acknowledging that they were deeply problematic, and that's a thing that happened. But to change them would be kind of, I think it'd be better just to put them in a drawer rather than try and update them for modern times. I think we just, moving forward as storytellers, just acknowledge that that was a thing, and then we just know that those are things that you can't, you know, are problematic in today's day and age when we're telling stories.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like I said, this is a subject that's going to come up a lot with these films. I mean, I'm already, the spoiler alert, I'm already very nervous about talking about Dumbo. Like, the you know, Dumbo is 75-80% this sublime, perfect, beautiful gem of a film. And then there's the ending with the crows. And you're just like, so yeah, it is a subject that was going to come up with a lot. And luckily, this is the only, of the shorts we've chosen, this is the only time where this really does come up as a subject. But talking about history and context and where they are now, I thought it was an important question to ask. Before we move on to the talking about the last short, there's one gag in this film that I want to bring up, which I fucking love. Did you notice the pictures on the wall in the house made of bricks?
I did. They made me laugh so much. What a great detail.
It's just, oh, so for listeners, if you haven't watched the short already, you look out for this. So there's a picture for mother. So it's like the pig's mother, and it's a sow nursing piglets. So that's very good. Then there's two pictures on the wall with the name, with father written on them, one of which is a string of sausages and one is a leg of ham. And my absolute favorite is Uncle Otto, which is a picture of a football.
Are they in the third house? They're in the brick house?
Yeah.
So great.
The first house, I think it's a scantily clad lady pig, and the second house, it's a scantily clad male pig, I think. But and that's kind of like the really lovely thing about this short, certainly by comparison to the other three the first three that we've watched, is there's so much comic detail in it. Like the frame is full of stuff. None of it feels pointless or unnecessary, but there's just so much. It's like a full gag. Everything about this is about entertaining you and making you laugh. It's such a delight. It's such a part, you know, we can watch on the Disney Plus version, you don't have to worry about the racism because it's not there. So you can just enjoy how joyously fun this thing is.
Yeah, it's really great. And I do love that, like, I think there's an interesting thing that came out of a Pixar masterclass that was had in Melbourne, which was, and I'm going to get this totally wrong, but they break it down into, like, in terms of telling jokes, having a certain amount of jokes for adults, kids of, like, adults, teenagers, let's say, and, like, little kids. And it's something like, you know, there's got to be a joke for little kids every, let's say, 5 minutes or 2 to 3 minutes or something, but they stagger it in terms of time. And it's really interesting because they cram so much humor into those films. And it's the same with this, like you were saying, this is the first time that you see a bit more complexity in terms of like them using as much as possible in terms of trying to squeeze jokes in, which is really cool.
And I mean, a joke like Uncle Otto being a football is such an adult joke. My housemate walked through the house when I was watching this one, and even he was like, looked at the TV. Oh, no, it was his girlfriend, looked at the TV and was like, oh my God, the father is a string of sausages. And I was like, it's just so wonderful, wonderfully clear and to the point and very, very, very funny.
Yeah, it's so great.
All right. Well, we've got one more short to talk about, and it's a big one. So we're now moving forward, actually quite a few years. We're moving forward to 1937 with one of the later Silly Symphony shorts, The Old Mill. Animals living in and around an old mill must find safety when the mill threatens to collapse during a storm. The Oscar-winning short The Old Mill was the 68th Silly Symphony, released in 1937, and was directed by Wilfred Jackson, who had gone as a sequence director on the early feature films. Its purpose was to test and demonstrate the newly developed multiplane camera process, a groundbreaking tool that changed the texture and visual scope of animation. The multiplane camera is a motion picture camera used in the animation process, where pieces of artwork on transparent layers move past the camera at varying speeds and distances, giving the sense of depth. An early version of the process was used in The Adventures of Prince Ahmed by director Lottie Reiniger in 1926, and later developed further by Arp Iwerks for Disney in 1933. The process first tested in The Old Mill was developed by William Garrity and used 7 layers of artwork painted in oil on glass shot by a vertical and movable camera. The Little Mermaid in 1989 was the last Disney film to use the process. And it makes a pretty fucking big difference. Like, it's pretty striking from the moment this short begins.
Yeah, it's very different in style. Even the animation style is clear, not even just in, like, using that process, but the actual, I found the, like, a lot of the animation to be more complex, I guess. Oh, sorry, a lot of the actual design of the animation to be a bit more complex.
There's more aim towards realism in this.
Well, I was going to say, it's really interesting, and I just saw in your notes that I hadn't read before, but when I was rewatching it this afternoon, I was like, this has got some real Hayao Miyazaki vibes. And then I read down the bottom, particularly the image of the windmill. Like, the windmill's got some real, like, Miyazaki vibes about it. And then I read further down just then, I was like, oh, you've said he's referred to it as his favourite Disney film.
Yeah, like, it makes sense, A, because of that aim towards realism, but still within the realm of the unreal with animation. Like, Miyazaki's films aim towards a sense of a more honest engagement with the natural world, but always remembering that animation rules mean you can kind of bend them a bit. But even just the way that there's a constant sense of peril, particularly when the storm hits and the mill starts to collapse, like that moment where you've got the blue bird who's taking care of her eggs and she's waiting and the rope on the wheel is going to break, and there's that very palpable sense of danger. Like, there was a point watching it where I was like, is he gonna fucking kill the bird? And then everything within it feels, it doesn't feel like anything's a gag in this. Everything feels like, even though it's like not a complete reflection of reality, everything feels like there's a genuine sense of tension, there's a genuine sense of danger, again, nothing is wasted. And we've kind of gone back in the complete opposite direction. This doesn't really have a story.
It sort of feels like we've got come full circle.
It's kind of like a nature documentary in an animated sense, and one where there's those really great moments where, like, the animals often look through the fourth wall at us. So it's almost like they're aware that we're present. Like, the owl gives us a confused look of, what are you doing here? The mice run away when they see us. We're present within the story. It feels a lot more, in a way that the other shorts feel very passive, this feels much more active. Like, we're, as an audience member, we're participants within whatever story it is that we're watching.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, too, there's a sort of a darkness to it that I think, you know, you were talking about with it being rooted more in reality, that it's the first time that I think, if you look at these 5 shorts as a whole, particularly this one with the 3 little pigs, so obviously the 3 little pigs is very up and very, like, there's, like, wonderful music and a song, and it's, like, very much when Disney musicals break into song, you're like, hey, that's Disney. But then with this one, it shows that, like, from here I go, I can see how you bring those 2 elements together to tell a really complex story that is going to frighten, you know, bring joy to. Like, it's really shows that, okay, the complexity in all of these shorts now, if you take all of those elements and bring them together, they're the ingredients for the features that they made. And particularly the more successful ones where there's levels, you know, there's a beautiful depth to the storytelling and the narratives.
This is the first short we've come across where it feels like we are now ready to start entering into films like Snow White and Pinocchio and Dumbo and Bambi and Fantasia. Like, it feels like it has, the way those films have such an incredible sense of danger to them. The previous shorts we've had don't have that sense. This is the first time where you have the sense of, the art form has reached a point where now it has to. It's almost like The Old Mill, in a way, is kind of pushing against the parameters of the 8-minute format. Like, you can see them going, we need to do something bigger. Like, this is too big to contain within 8 minutes, even though it's a perfectly executed 8 minute little story. It makes sense that now it's like, now we have to do something else. We have to push against the edges. And yet, like, as much as there is such a, like, it was praised for its realistic depiction of animal behavior, complex lighting, color effects. They were developing, it wasn't just multiple in camera they were developing with this, they're developing special effects around wind and rain and water, and like a more three-dimensional quality of animation. But there's still charming character moments. Like, my favorite moment in it is when the frogs come out of on the lily pad and start croaking and making music. And the first one that comes out is constantly surprised every time someone else makes a noise. And the animation is so, like, it looks like a frog. Like, it looks like a cartoon version of a frog, but it looks much more like a frog than like we would have seen in, say, something like Flowers and Trees. And there's that kind of the squatch and scratch process of, like, elongating expressions and exaggerating them. But it's so, there's so much detail in the minute movements and, like, the minute details of that animation that make it so, like, I broke out into a huge smile the minute those frogs came on screen. Like, I giggled because it was just so, it was so delightful.
How interesting, too, that, like, talking about coming full circle, that, like, in that those first couple of shorts, there was, like, concern about animal cruelty. And then, you know, what, 8 years later, we have this beautiful short that gets us to worry about the welfare of animals. It's a very, very funny thing to have come full circle with.
And also, it's like the way that it depicts the natural world as being things happen and they happen and there's nothing you can do about it, but the world continues. Like, the mill is blown, it starts to collapse in the storm, and then when the storm passes and it's kind of leaning on its side and it's falling apart, all the animals are still like, well, the owl is still sitting on the same perch it was sitting on before, and the eggs are, like, the nest is still in the same groove within the wheel that it was in before, and the mice are still doing their thing, and the bats come back that left at the beginning. Like, it's just the natural world just keeps going. There's no, like, it has a climax, but it doesn't necessarily have a normal narrative conclusion. It feels a bit like a poem in a way. All of the shorts that we've talked about are works of art, without question. This is the one where you kind of go, but this is an artwork. Like, it's the most undeniable work of art.
Yeah, this is my favorite. In terms of, like, the design and the actual animation style, this is by far my favorite.
And, you know, its influence is pretty significant. You know, you can see the water effects further developed in Pinocchio and Fantasia. Bambi is, like, is hugely influenced by this, because Bambi is a very similar, it's like the concept of the old mill dragged out to just over an hour. The same idea of, like, watching animals interact with themselves in their natural habitats, the way that, you know, life and death and birth and renewal and all those processes are natural processes that we don't have any control over. And, like, yeah, they even borrowed things in later on, like the wind effects and the quality of the storm, and the terror of the storm pops up again in Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad, like, 20 years later. This feels like a short that has a tremendous amount of artistic significance, not just to Disney animation, but to the animation process itself. It feels like they're ready to get into the really big works after this, which they are, because Snow White is only a month away. This was released a month before Snow White.
So these arguably would have been in production at the same time?
Yes. This would have been, in the way that, you know, all the other shorts we've talked about in some respects were testing a technology out, this was really what the old mill's existence was. It's probably one of the reasons why story is secondary in it, because it's about, how can we use the technology and push the technology further to create endearing characters and tell a simple story? Only a month later, Snow White comes out and the world changes, essentially. The world of animation, the world of cinema, the world of distribution, everything changes. And so this is kind of like the last moment before that. And it won, like, you know, Flowers and Trees and Three Little Pigs, it won the best short subject Oscar at that Academy Awards in 1937. Obviously, I mean, it's kind of an undeniable one. Well, that then brings us to the end of the shorts. So now, you know, the old mill has come out, everyone is impressed, and the world of animation is about to change with the release of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which, unfortunately, I don't get to talk about with you. I have to talk about that with somebody else. But have you enjoyed, like, did you enjoy the process of going through and revisiting or introducing yourself to some of these shorts?
I'm a big fan of looking back on things, particularly because I find the history of cinema so interesting. I feel like, again, you know, I came to it late, because obviously I was involved in the industry from a young age, but in terms of being a huge lover of cinema and making movies, I came to it quite late. So, you know, until there were a lot of things that I hadn't seen. So looking back on things and looking back on things, particularly with the experience that I've had now, just in general as an actor, a director, a filmmaker, is I'm fascinated to see, you know, early works that really set up the future of their particular discipline. And, you know, Disney is obviously undeniable in what they did for animation and what Walt Disney in particular, I guess, and his cohort did for animation and the effect that, I mean, for the fact that I looked at the old mill and was like, this has got some, like, I love Studio Ghibli. Studio Ghibli is one of my favorite animation houses. And to look at the old mill, look back at the old mill and go, oh God, that's good, has some real Miyazaki style feel about it. And then to learn that it was one of his favorite shorts is pretty incredible. So yeah, it's been really great. Really, really cool.
Well, one last question before I let you go from this podcast prison. We've been talking for so many hours about this stuff. One question I intend to ask everyone of my guests, because this is, I love asking this kind of question. What's your favorite Disney film?
Oh, that is so hard.
If you had to pick one, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask this question on every episode, and at the end of this whole endeavor, I'm going to tally up what everyone said to say what the primarily favorite Disney film of all of our guests has been. So you can only pick one, I'm afraid.
Look, I reckon it would probably be only because when I think, you know, always with these things, I feel like the first instinct is always the right instinct, because then you overthink it. Probably The Lion King, I'd say, because The Lion King is so... I've watched that absolutely more than any other Disney film, but it is the first one that jumps to mind from my childhood that I remember watching and being obsessed with. So yeah, I'd probably say that would be my favorite, but to be honest, I think that Aladdin wouldn't be too far behind either, which is probably an interesting one. But yeah, the Lion King definitely is the first one that jumps to mind.
Well, I think I have a feeling that's going to be one that a lot of people are going to say. It's probably one of my least favorite Disney films, so I'm just going to have to smile and live with it.
I'm so sorry.
Don't apologize.
But I think it's comes from a, like, when I was a kid, and when you think, like, I mean, obviously that was one that came out when we were all kids. So yeah, they kind of were probably in the hotspot before I felt like I was maybe a bit too cool for those movies and started pretending that I didn't like them when I was going through my weird teenage phase. But those two and The Little Mermaid are the three that probably stick in my mind the most. Do I get to ask yours, or are you saving that for the final episode?
Look, I know everyone's going to ask me that question. My favorite's Beauty and the Beast. Beauty and the Beast is my favorite Disney film.
Oh, yeah, good one, good one.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually it'd be in my top 10 favorite films of all time, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect film.
So I'm assuming you're a huge fan of the Emma Watson live action remake?
It's a war crime. That film is a war crime. The Hague have put new rules in to do with a crime of that magnitude.
Did you say it, or did you ignore it because you were like, I know I'm going
to
hate it?
No, I did. I went to see it and I cried through most of it out of just... Because I'm not we're definitely going on a tangent now. I'm not a nostalgic person. I should warn this actually to listeners before they embark on listening to this whole endeavor with me. I'm not a nostalgic person, so I don't have that thing of like, oh, this thing from my childhood. Most of the things that I love from my childhood, if I still love them now, it's because I've revisited them and just love them for what they are. So I did my reaction, my hatred of the live action Beauty and the Beast was actually nothing to do with the fact that they had ruined this thing I loved as a kid, because that's still fine. It's still sitting on my shelf at home. It was just, as an adaptation, it was lazy, and as a film, it was terrible. And I just got really angry watching it and started crying out of frustration and just walked out of the cinema. And then I think I wrote the review on Switch for it, which is quite ripe from memory. If anyone wants to go look it up, it's not very, very pleasant. Have you seen the remake of The Lion King? If you're going to ask me that, I'm going to ask you that. Have you seen the remake of The Lion King?
I started watching it in a hotel room when I was away for work, and I found myself, I don't know how it happened, but I found myself about 10 minutes into it, I just started to do work because I was so bored. It's amazing how, and like, don't get me wrong, I actually quite like Jon Favreau as a director, and I didn't hate the live-action Jungle Book as much as most other people did. I didn't love it, but I didn't despise it, and I actually think he's a very clever filmmaker, but that was just shit. It was such a pile of shit. It was one of the worst things I've ever seen.
Be thankful you watched it in a place where you could turn it off. I was at the premiere, the IMAX premiere of it, and there was a moment later in the film where my body went into flight or fight mode of, like, something happened and my brain just started going, leave, leave, you need to leave now, you need to leave the cinema now for your own personal safety, you need to leave.
I've got to say, having seen movies with you and having seen movies with you that you've hated, it's really fun sitting next to you because you have such a physical reaction when you hate something.
And the great thing with this was everyone else in the cinema was having the same reaction. Like, just I looked across at the, like, through the IMAX cinema and everyone's just kind of like, oh my God. Anyway, we could talk about this subject forever, but Nick, if our listeners want to find you or find out more information about late night films, where would they go?
Right. You can go on the internet and just look at look up late night films. But late night is spelled L-A-T-E-N-I-T-E because at the time we thought we were being very clever. Turns out we were just young and in university. You follow me on Instagram at Nick Collar. Don't have a Twitter because I'm not cool enough. But otherwise, yeah, check out Late Night Films. We do lots of interesting stuff. And our short Rebooted, which will be well and truly out by the time this goes to air, I imagine, is a really fun look at the history of visual effects and animation. So if you're a fan, look it up. It's called Rebooted, and you'll be able to find it on our website.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Nick, for first of all, for taking on the enormous task of talking about five films as opposed to just one. That's a lot of shorts. And thank you for being our very first guest on Ink and Paint.
No, thank you. It's been fun. It's been really fun. I really enjoyed it.
On the next episode of Ink and Paint.
It goes without saying almost that it is a product of its time in terms of its politic, and there's no avoiding that fact.
Acclaimed theatre maker and co-artistic director of The Rabble, Emma Valente, joins me as we look at the one that started it all, the first Disney animated classic, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. A big thanks once again to Nicholas Collar for joining me on this episode, the second part of our chat about the early shorts. You can find more about his company, Late Night Films, at www.latenightfilms.com, as well as on Facebook, Twitter, and Vimeo. Be sure to check out the show notes on this episode for more information about the shorts we've discussed at inkandpaint.com.au, including links to the shorts themselves and a short piece from Nick about what Disney means to him. Since we're just starting off in this new podcasting adventure, we'd love to hear from you. Hit us up with your comments, thoughts, and even memories of your favourite Disney films, and we'll be sure to share them on our upcoming episodes. You can email Daniel at inkandpaint.com.au or find me on Twitter at Daniel Lamon. We'll be releasing new episodes every fortnight, so if you enjoyed the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favourite podcasting platform. And don't forget to tell your friends. Ink and Paint was created, hosted, and written by myself, Daniel Lamon, and produced and edited by Alex Amster. Music is composed by Sam Porter. The show artwork is designed by Nicholas Pirinakis, with episode illustrations by Lily Meek, and the podcast is released through Switch. MakeTheSwitch.com.au. Join in next time on Ink and Paint to continue our journey through the Disney animated classics. Great. That's it. Oh my God, we've done it. Oh my God, we've actually done it. My God. Oh no.